The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 14, Episode 23. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing three tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Kyle Harrison and Warren Benedetto. Tonight we'll hear stories of nebulous neighbors, weird wanderers, and dangerous doorways. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. So many universes, so little time. We have the inner world of the microscopic. We have outer space, which houses things we can barely imagine. And then, of course, there's the possibility that there are universes that lie next to ours, metaphorically speaking, anyway. There could be ones where there are many different copies of you, but each one is slightly different and potentially murderous. Or maybe there are ones where the rules of reality are completely different and things we cannot and should not understand lie in wait for the unwary. Tonight, we'll be taking a little trip through the dimensional gateways and see what we can find. In our first tale, Kyle Harrison has us meet a very brilliant but also very disturbed neighbor who could go to great lengths to fix this tragedy, and of the man next door who just wants to help him. Of course, there may be answers they discover to questions they never wanted asked. Without further ado, I present to you Grief Begets Chaos. Andrea was only 9 when she went missing. According to her brother Hudson, she was exactly 9 years, 3 months, and 17 days old. We met when he was passing out flyers with her picture plastered on them under the large red words, "Missing." When it first happened, the entire community came together to try and find her. Her parents had money. Her father, Gabriel, was working as a quantum engineer at a local university not far from town, and they spent almost every cent they had on search parties, media reports, and police investigations. After a year of searching, Andrea was found, and I'm sad to say she was dead. Her little body had drowned in a local lake not 1 week after Hudson had put up those flyers. It affected each of the family members in a different way. Her mother took it the worst, I think, divorcing Gabriel and going back north to be with her family. According to rumors, Gabriel was supposed to have been watching Andrea that weekend, but had chosen to go to work instead. He thought a 9-year-old could handle being alone at the house for 8 to 12 hours without supervision. I was honestly surprised their marriage lasted so long during the search for Andrea. Maybe they were both hoping for a happy ending, as if seeing Andrea alive again could salvage their love for one another. Hudson wasn't much better off. He was almost in college when it happened, and he constantly blamed himself for everything. Gabriel actually allowed this behavior, I think, to lighten some of the burden on his conscience. Eventually, it drove a wedge between them, and he left as well, and the physicist was alone in a big house across the street. Gabriel lost his job shortly after that, not for being a poor employee, but because he actually wanted to work longer hours, so much so that he didn't shower or care for himself properly. Other university officials began to complain. My son, who was a student there and a close friend of Hudson's, said that Gabriel had often worked 16 to 18 hours without sleep. All of it was very sad to watch, especially because the outcome felt very inevitable. The family was broken even before Andrea disappeared. When the funeral was over and the media forgot about the poor little girl, no one was there to keep them together anymore. She was the linchpin to their entire lives. You'd think that would be the end of this little story, a sad little tale about a sad little family. But it only takes a darker turn from here, I'm afraid. I don't think I was prepared for everything that Gabriel did after he lost his daughter. No one was. But I think the world needs to hear about it. If no one learns anything about his mistakes, at least my own soul will feel at ease for the role I played in this tragedy. You see, after Gabriel lost his wife and son and became a bit of a recluse, I thought it was my duty as a neighbor to try and bring him back to humanity, show him there was a reason to keep going. I've seen cases like this where people hang themselves, and I just couldn't allow that sort of outcome for a man as broken as he was. I told myself I could fix him. It started out innocently. After all, we already had been sort of close friends before all this happened. Our younger children knew each other. Sometimes we'd exchange pleasantries as we returned from work. I'm not about to say that our relationship was anything more than that, but when the searches went out, I was certainly a part of them. I couldn't imagine that type of thing happening to my boy Isaac. I even sat near to Gabriel during the funeral and promised I'd check up on him regularly, even as the gossip and fanfare died down. His money spent, his family gone, the poor man didn't have a reason in the world to keep going, so I made it my mission to provide him one. We'd exchanged books. I knew it was one of the few things he had a passion for. He insisted on nothing fictional, so I'd try my best to impress him with some great stories I'd found in my own travels. It was harmless, until the day I offered him a book that I should have destroyed. I work at a travel insurance agency, and during my career, I've had the chance to meet people who collect antique pieces of literature. Since I often get gifts from clients, I wind up with a few here and there. Most of them sit in my basement unread, collecting dust. When I told Gabriel about it, he thought it was the most sinful thing he could ever imagine. All that wasted time and knowledge just being used for my own personal altar to my ego. I was ashamed, so I told him I'd find some in my collection to give to him. But I swore I'd read them first. That way I knew what I was recommending wouldn't be hogwash. During the loss of Andrea, though, I forgot all about this promise and decided to give him one that I hadn't even touched. It simply sounded like it would be something to give him a little bit of comfort. It was the work of an old Egyptian folklore mixed with some history called the Lazarus Record, and most of it was way beyond my understanding of science and history and religion. I figured since it only made me feel like an inferior person, a mind such as his would appreciate it. When he saw it, he seemed to immediately recognize it and almost snatched it out of my hands, asking where I got it from. I honestly didn't even remember, and he, being the bibliophile, went on to tell me that it could possibly be the rarest item I'd ever collected. Supposedly, every single copy of the book had been destroyed either by religious extremists, disasters, or other means, to the point that the mere suggestion of an actual physical copy of it was considered a legend. He told me that I should donate it to a museum, but I wasn't interested in something like that, so I told him to keep it since he seemed to like it so much. I didn't understand that it would be his new obsession for the next few months. At first, after I gave him the weighty tome, things seemed to get better. I saw him more frequently out of the house, going either to the store or to the library. He'd even drive to the university because I'd see him return with a few textbooks from his old office. I thought maybe he was going to get his job back, but then I saw one of his colleagues follow him back to the house and shout at his door. Gabriel had been stealing the items from the university, and they were about to charge him with the crime. He spoke calmly to the other men, insisting it was all for a good cause. I could hear their conversation, even with my TV on. I was hoping Gabriel was telling the truth, and this was all just a misunderstanding. The other man calmed down and said he'd come back the next day for the items. Once their argument ended, I saw Gabriel hurriedly return to the house. I really shouldn't have stuck my nose into his business, but I'm a boring guy and have little else to distract myself with when my wife isn't home. She would tell me that I needed to leave it alone and just spend time with our son, but honestly, what Gabriel did next concerned me. We were having dinner, and I sent my son out to check the mailbox. I saw Gabriel out there on the front porch waiting for his guest, and he waved at my son, asking if he was still enjoying college. He even asked about Hudson, and I wondered if the man was a bit jealous that we had a connection to his family that we didn't. Then the college from the university arrived, and the two entered the house. The next day, the other man's car was still parked outside, and the day after that, too. Then a tow truck came and took it to be impounded. I asked Gabriel about it the day after that, and he acted like I was confused. He insisted he didn't even have a guest over for dinner that night. But I knew that something must have happened because of the next incident. He was gathering more materials from the university, but this time only leaving and returning during the night. I'm a light sleeper, and every time he opened his garage door, I'd hear. My wife said I should call the police. Maybe that would have been wise. But instead, I decided this time I'd be the one to confront him. Maybe he overreacted to his coworker because they weren't friends. I waited until my wife was at work and went over to knock on his door. On the way across the street, something else happened. It was like the entire neighborhood lost power all of a sudden. I heard this loud hum coming from Gabriel's house, and then the street lights flickered. The noise got louder, and the bulbs in the street suddenly shattered. I heard a few neighbors muttering and complaining and looking around in confusion as I hurried to Gabriel's house. Somehow, I knew something had just occurred, and I needed to investigate. I pounded on the door, demanding he respond. Eventually, he creaked the door open, his face as pale as a ghost. He looked lost and confused and angry, surprised I was there. He shooed me away and insisted everything was fine, slamming the door and locking it. I swore I heard him whisper Andrea's name as he retreated into the bleak house. I went back home and decided that would be the last time I offered a helping hand. I knew I was getting too involved in something that didn't affect me. But fate had a way of keeping me close to his family, because the next day, as I went to check the mailbox myself, I saw something that should have been impossible. Gabriel was in the garage and tinkering with his car, but I saw a silhouette of another person in the bedroom window. I actually dropped the mail on the ground when I saw the figure. Gabriel noticed my shock. For the first time in months, he smiled. Then I heard a little girl's voice from up in the room, and he headed back inside. I shuffled the mail back into my hands and hurried inside, trying to comprehend what I saw. The person in the window looked just like Andrea. But that was impossible. I'd been to the funeral. I'd seen her body in that casket. What, I wondered morbidly, had Gabriel done to bring her back from the dead? I told my wife what I saw that very night after our son went to bed. She was equally concerned, but thought maybe I needed to seek therapy. I insisted it was no mirage, and I actually felt frustrated she didn't believe me. She apologized, but said that if I was going to prove Andrea was alive, I needed to go over to that house and find evidence. It's been 3 days since I'd seen the girl, and so far Gabriel hadn't left the house. All the rest of the neighborhood had regained power except for him. Surely he needed food and water by now. So where was he getting it? Was he finding a way to hide it in the same way he hid Andrea? I decided to try to talk to him again. This time he was far more hostile and denied everything that I was asking about him. I tried to be helpful, but I could tell that this man was losing what little sanity he had left. Whatever was happening to his daughter, it had made him go insane. Since he first refused to give me details, I took things a step further and contacted Andrea's mother. She was surprised that I made the attempt because we hadn't been in touch since the funeral, but when she heard what I had to say, she agreed to come back. I insisted that she couldn't confront Gabriel openly or go to the police. They would think all of this was some elaborate prank, and Gabriel would likely find a way to hide Andrea all over again if she went straight to him. Thankfully, she listened. I told my wife about our plan, and she even let her stay at our place. As long as Gabriel didn't see her, I thought things would go smoothly. Then we began a long wait. I kept trying to get a glimpse of Andrea again, but it was obvious that Gabriel had moved her to a different room after I noticed the first time. How was he making sure her needs were met? It made all of us worry. On the fourth day, Gabriel's wife insisted we needed to do something to make him leave. There had to be a way to distract him, she insisted. My wife thought that her presence there might be the key, and so we concocted a simple plan. She would go to her ex-husband and say she came back to reconcile with him, get him out of the house for at least an hour, and I'd be able to sneak in and find Andrea. I will admit it was a rather hastily arranged situation, but we were desperate. We knew Andrea might be in danger from being locked up for so long. The next day, around 10 a.m., she went over to the house and got Gabriel to come out. To say that he was surprised by her arrival would be an understatement, but he also seemed naturally suspicious. I suppose, given all the illegal things he'd been involved in, I could see why he would feel that way. I didn't overhear their conversation, but somehow she managed to get him to leave the house. As soon as they were down the street, my wife encouraged me to sneak in via the garage. He always kept it open, and I knew there was also a spare key under a flower pot. During all of his clandestine activity, Gabriel was still a creature of habit. My wife's role was to keep watch and text me if they were going to return. I managed to get back into the garage easily and soon was inside. I'm not entirely sure what I thought I might find upon entering, but I was rather surprised by the lack of anything that resembled a home. Gabriel had stacks of books and boxes of wires and equipment in every single section of his downstairs. The wires were all connected and routed to something on the second floor, and despite the fact that I knew there was no power, I could hear what sounded like a television above me. At the bottom of the stairs, I called out to Andrea but didn't get a response. Time was critical, so I went up to investigate the source of the noise. It was coming from the only room that seemed to have any functionality, Andrea's old bedroom. But I could also see it was locked with three different types of bolts. Gabriel was keeping her here against her will, I realized. I didn't want to alert her to my arrival, but I was sure I could get her out, so I started to look around for anything that might unfasten the door. That was when I saw what he had been spending so much time on these past few months. It was in the room opposite Andrea's, and what I can guess was probably once his master bedroom. Except now it was completely transformed into some kind of laboratory. There was a large conduit of machinery shaped like a ring near the east side, and then a menagerie of wires running across the ceiling to what looked like a hole in the wall. The hole almost resembled the shape of a keyhole, and even though none of the machinery was on, it felt like everything in the room was alive and watching me. I took a step toward the hole and realized that the hole in the wall seemed to shimmer and twinkle the way a pool of water might. Dark, mysterious, and endless, I couldn't really see the other side. There was a laptop next to a small workspace on the other side of the room that was still active, and I saw that it was where Gabriel had been logging his strange experiments. Even though I should have been focusing on saving Andrea, I felt compelled to search through his files. He'd been vlogging the work he'd done on this strange contraption, and most of the video feed was his tireless efforts. Then I paused when I saw a video that had my name on it. I don't know why, but I clicked on it. What Gabriel had to say in it was surprising. I'm sure you're wondering why I made this video or how I knew that you would find this. We can discuss that later. First, I need to explain what this is. Behind him in the video, he flipped a switch, and I saw a surge of energy explode in the wall. The hole was opening and becoming wider and larger and brighter. Thanks to the efforts of my colleagues at the university and my own discoveries within the Lazarus record, I have finally unlocked the key to traveling to other dimensions. I know this breakthrough is a dangerous one and can't be shared with the world. It would be a tool that would change our entire society, but not for the better. It is my burden to bear, and with it comes the sins I must commit if I hope to make my life right again. The video skipped to showing him dragging an unconscious Andrea out of the portal. He showed a mark on her right hand. This parallel universe seems to almost mirror our own. I found my daughter, still alive and thriving in it, and brought her back here to be with me. In that other place, the family she was with was not loving or kind. So by bringing her back here, I've performed a mercy. I feel confident that eventually she'll grow to love me and accept me as her father. The video showed Andrea trying to fight back against her captor, and I covered my mouth as Gabriel addressed me personally. I know what happened on the lake. I know because Andrea told me. In the other universe, you took our Hudson and drowned him instead. And you kept up the ruse for so long that everyone felt sorry for your family instead of ours. I guess in some ways, the universes are the same, but the charade's over, because I've set things into motion so that both universes can have harmony again. The clip ended, and I felt my heart beat faster as I tried to imagine what he meant. Then, from behind, I heard a voice and saw Andrea was actually out of her room. She looked frightened to see me. As I looked in her eyes of sadness, they warped to rage, and I felt something hit the back of my skull, losing consciousness. The next thing I knew, I had zip ties on my hands and feet, and I was in a chair in the room I thought was Andrea's prison. And I saw her parents standing in front of me. The wife spoke first, slapping me across the face and shouting. She had never known I was responsible for Andrea's death. Gabriel stood by and said nothing. Maybe he knew the reason all along. The guilt I carried. How could I have ever explained to them that it was an accident? Would it have even mattered now? Gabriel showed me a written confession in my handwriting that explained how I had foolishly tried to take Andrea on the lake that fateful day. Then they showed me what was really in the locked room. My face went pale as I saw a mirror version of myself, half-starved, looking frantic for release. They had gotten the confession from the other universe. Gabriel smiled and said, "Now both of us were going to get what we deserved." Then he took up a gun and gave it to the doppelganger. He looked deranged and desperate for any kind of escape. So, without even hesitation, he shouted for God to forgive, and then shoved the weapon in his mouth and pulled the trigger. Gabriel kicked the gun away from the corpse and told me I was next, except he said a different fate was going to wait for me. Now that he had his family again, it was time I paid a price. He activated his gateway to the other dimension. I saw the swirling portal and I knew his intentions. I begged for his forgiveness and his understanding. Then he shoved me into the portal without hesitation. I saw him and his wife holding Andrea and smiling as I fell into the void. My entire world seemed to flip upside down. On the other side of the portal, I was in an empty house. I could only guess. The mirror versions of Gabriel and his family might not even live here anymore. Behind me, the portal closed and disappeared. I guess Gabriel had dismantled the machinery after pushing me in. I crawled out to the front porch, shouting to my house for help. An older gentleman came out. He helped me out of my zip ties and had dozens of questions. The most important one was whether to contact the police or not. I told him I was fine, even though I was shaken and frightened by my circumstances. That was almost 3 weeks ago. I'm trapped here now, in this mirror world, trying to make sense of things. I've learned that my mirror family died after my mirror self-disappeared. My wife committed suicide and my son in a terrible car crash. I could only assume it was some kind of divine karma for the secrets I kept. I've seen the mirror, Gabriel, from afar, but I can tell his life is no better now than his other self. Andrea, missing in this universe, will likely drive him insane as well. In this strange way, everything repeats itself. I was a monster and a fool for thinking my good deeds could heal what had been lost. Maybe I deserve to be trapped here. Maybe I need to find a way out of the way my other self did. Clearly the guilt got to him. Maybe that's yet another way this endless cycle continues. Even though everyone here believes this is the normal world, let me assure you there are others just beyond the surface that seek being found. Maybe it was all meant to be this way because of my guilt and my attempts at trying to be a good person. Fate's a fickle mistress, and I'm not sure I know how to live in a world where I know I don't belong. I hope you enjoyed Grief Begets Chaos by Kyle Harrison, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Kyle-Harrison. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/KYLE-HARRISON. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. Guilt can be a great motivator. It's really something, how a little thing, like accidental killing somebody, can get people to do the right thing, eventually. But sometimes it's not who comes from the parallel world, but what. Warren Benedetto, in our next story, shows us someone not looking for what lurks on the other side of reality, but what might be looking for you when you don't even know it's there. Without further ado, I present to you Feed the Worm. My tires rumbled as my car drifted over the wet line and onto the shoulder of the road. The lane departure warning beeped insistently, screaming at me to wake up. My eyes snapped open and I slammed on the brakes. Grit and gravel rattled against the underside of my car as I swerved to avoid a deer crossing sign that had materialized in my path. My back tires fishtailed along the crumbling blacktop, momentarily threatening to send my car into a spin before regaining traction. After recentering the car in its proper lane, I glanced into my rearview mirror at the twin spirals of road dust swirling in my taillights. The smell of burnt rubber singed my nostrils. My heart pounded like a double kick drum in my chest. Holy crap, that was close. I poked at the touchscreen on the dashboard until the opening riffs of Master of Puppets by Metallica filled the car. I nudged the volume a little higher, then began drumming my fingers against the steering wheel in time with the music. I glanced in the rearview mirror again, this time examining the smooth curve of my bald pate. My hairband days and my hair were long gone. I sighed, then returned my attention to the black stretch of asphalt racing under my headlights. The road was a long, winding scar, carved through miles of otherwise unspoiled forest. It was completely deserted, which was exactly why I liked it. It gave me plenty of time to think. There were no other cars, no houses, not even a street lamp. The sky offered a breathtaking display of planets and stars, as if someone had scattered a bucket of silver glitter on a black velvet tablecloth. A full moon was a perfect circle surrounded by a soft halo of white light that cast an eerie glow on the low ground fog drifting between the trees. As my car rounded a curve, my headlights illuminated a woman shambling along the side of the road in the distance. She was of medium build and wore an oversized white t-shirt over what looked like boxer shorts. She walked with an odd gait, sort of a shuffling stride, her bare feet kicking up little clouds of dust that danced in the glow of the headlights. A silver bracelet with a small heart charm dangled from her wrist, under a tattoo of an angel that stretched up her forearm. Her legs were crosshatched with fresh scratches, as if she had just stumbled out of the woods through a wall of thorns. My foot drifted to the brake, slowing my car as it drew closer to the girl. I reached out and killed the music, leaving only the shushing sound of my tires on the blacktop. I scanned the trees for a driveway, mailbox, or any sign of civilization that might indicate where the girl had come from, and there was nothing. I hadn't passed any disabled vehicles either, at least not that I could remember. I supposed her car could have broken down somewhere up ahead, but then why would she be walking back in that direction, on my side of the road? And why was she dressed, or undressed, like she was? It looked like she'd just climbed out of bed by way of a briar patch. My tires crunched in the dirt on the side of the road as I rolled up beside the girl. I lowered my passenger side window, leaning over from the driver's seat to see her better. She seemed to be in her late teens. Her teeth were chattering. No wonder it was 40 degrees outside. She was definitely not dressed for the weather. Hell, she was barely dressed at all. I called to the girl through the open window. Hey there, you okay? The girl stopped walking. She didn't respond. She didn't even look in my direction. She just stood on the shoulder, staring straight ahead into the distance. I brought my car to a stop and put it in park. I briefly considered shutting off the engine, then decided it would be safer to keep it running. I opened the driver's side door and stepped out onto the road. The car warned me about the open door with a persistent ding, ding, ding. I closed it and walked around the hood of the vehicle. The headlights threw my shadow far down the road as I crossed in front of them. "Hey," I said again, waving my hand to get the girl's attention. Her eyes darted in my direction, and I recoiled slightly. She was looking at me, but she didn't seem to be seeing me. "Everything all right?" "No," the girl replied, her voice barely a whisper. "Did something happen?" "Not yet." "Not yet," I thought. "What kind of answer's that?" I wasn't sure how to respond. Instead, I asked, "You have a name?"
"Amy."
"Hi, Amy. I'm Ben." The girl just looked at me blankly. I blew warm air into my hands. "Listen, it's freezing out here. Can I give you a ride somewhere?"
"No."
There was no concern in her voice, no sense of danger. Her response was simple, matter of fact. You sure? You're going to get sick dressed like that. I waited for an awkward moment to see if the girl would respond. She didn't. What are you doing out here anyway? Your car break down, or... I trailed off, then tried again. You live out here somewhere? The girl didn't answer. I shrugged. All right, well, I'm going to go then. Good luck. I stepped back toward the driver's side and then paused, chewing on my thumbnail for a few seconds while I stopped to think. Finally, I turned back to her. Look, I don't feel right leaving you alone like this. It's not safe. I know. You're all by yourself? The girl shook her head no. I looked around, suddenly worried, but there was nobody else in sight. Someone's coming for you. Mm-hmm. Really? Who? The girl stared down the road past me. Them. I turned, expecting to see a car approaching. But there was nothing, just a yellow-lined blacktop disappearing into the darkness. I looked back at the girl, ready to ask what the hell she was talking about. And she was gone. Hey! I blurted out. I came around the front of my car to the passenger side, thinking maybe she'd passed out on the side of the road. She wasn't there. Where'd she go? I scanned the nearby woods. The tree line was too far. Across an expanse of knee-high grass, she couldn't have gone that way. There was no sound, no movement. Amy! I half-jogged a few steps along the passenger side and around to the back of the car. The girl was on her knees, crouched low behind the rear bumper. Exhaust swirled around her, lit up by a hellish red by the glow of the taillights. Her hair hung over her face in damp ropes. Breath streamed from her nose in short, rapid bursts. She looked up at me. Her eyes were wide with terror. Hide! She whispered. I ducked down behind the car with her. I could feel my pulse hammering in my ears. From what? The girl didn't answer. She peered around the edge of the trunk, then quickly drew back. I listened and waited. After about a minute, I started to feel foolish. There was nothing out there. The girl was just paranoid. She was probably strung out on meth or something. She was hallucinating. I raised myself until I could see through the rear window and onto the road in front. I could dimly make out the silhouette of a deer grazing on a spray of dandelions on the shoulder of the road. As if sensing my gaze, the deer looked up at me, chewed lazily for a moment, then bolted off into the woods. Seriously? I gave an exasperated sigh and stood up. Look, this is ridiculous. Do you want a ride or not? Last chance. The girl stood and stepped out tentatively from behind the car. No, she replied. They're coming for me. All right, then. I threw up my hands in defeat and headed back to the driver's side. See ya. And for you, too. I turned and walked back toward the girl, my eyes narrowing. What'd you say? The girl looked at me, through me, it seemed. They know. Her words sent a shot of adrenaline through my body. I masked my alarm with an air of casual dismay. Oh, yeah? What do they know? Everything. The girl started laughing. It was a broken sound, joyless. She covered her mouth with her hand. The silver bracelet slid down from her wrist to her forearm. The heart pendant glimmering red in the reflected glow of the taillights. I felt a surge of anger. The girl was mocking me. Something funny? The girl shook her head. She was still laughing, though. Tears streamed down her cheek, tracing fresh tracks through her smeared mascara. She pulled her hand away from her face, revealing yellow teeth slicked with blood and saliva. Glistening strings of bloody drool stretched between her lips and dribbled down her chin. She laughed even harder. There was something else in her laugh, underneath a gurgling, liquid sound, phlegmy, the sound of pneumonia, of fluids pooled in lungs, of drowning from the inside.
See her,
she whispered. See who? Alexis. My stomach lurched. I don't know what you're talking about. I see you too. You're nuts, okay? I began backing away from her. The girl matched me step for step, advancing. I held out my hand as if to ward her off. Just stay away from me. You'll do it again. I didn't do anything. Suddenly, the girl let out an animal snarl and lunged at me. She swiped her arm, raking her nails across my cheek and opening a gash under my eye. I instinctively dodged to the side, simultaneously tripping the girl and pushing her. The shove accelerated her forward momentum, sending her headfirst into the corner of the car's hood. Her skull hit the metal with a sound like a rotten melon dropping from the sky. The girl crumbled to the ground, collapsing into a tangled pile of limbs. Her head lolled to the side at a grotesque angle. A thick river of crimson spilled from her hairline and pooled in one of her open eyes, filling the socket with blood. She didn't blink. I paced in front of my car, mumbling under my breath as I played out the inevitable police interview in my mind. What was I going to say? It was dark, the girl came out of nowhere, ran right in front of my car. I tried to swerve, but it was too late. I thought I'd hit a deer. I didn't realize it was a person until I got out of the car and saw the body in the road. It was an accident. A terrible, terrible accident. I imagined the cop's response. Another accident? I looked down at the girl's body sprawled in front of my car, then touched the gash on my cheek. Who was I kidding? Nobody would believe it was an accident. My car was undamaged. The road behind it was unspoiled. There was no skid mark, no burnt rubber. No indication that I'd braked or swerved at all. Not here, at least. The part of the road where I'd dozed off was miles behind me. And how would I explain the cut in my face? She'd have my skin under her nails, my DNA on her hands. I could try to clean it off, but what if I missed some? Then I'd really be screwed. The cops would start to doubt my story. They'd question my motives, maybe look into my background. And what would they find? God damn it, I cursed to myself. How could I let this happen again? I stopped next to the girl's lifeless form. I wasn't sure how she knew what she seemed to know. How could she know about Alexis? But that didn't matter anymore. I had to deal with the present situation. I had no time to worry about the past. Circling behind the girl, I slid my hands under her armpits and lifted. Her head flopped backward, her dark hair trailing along the ground as I dragged her through the tall grass and into the woods. I lowered her to the dirt behind the trunk of a large fallen tree. She stared sightlessly at the forest canopy above. Dried leaves clung to her hair. One arm was splayed out at her side, the other was draped across her stomach. I rocked the fallen tree with my foot to see if it would roll. It was heavy, but I could move it. Kneeling on the carpet of wet leaves next to the body, I slid up my sleeves and then plunged my fingers into the dirt. The ground was soft and damp with a dark, earthy smell that reminded me of the compost at my grandfather's farm. It was the smell of decay, of decomposition. The forest was teeming with life that fed on death. I would bury the body as best as I could with my bare hands, roll the fallen tree over it, and then let nature do the rest. As I began scooping handfuls of leaves and dirt onto the body, covering it with a thick layer of debris, the girl moved. Jesus! I backpedaled away from the body, startled by the unexpected motion. My elbow slammed into the dead tree behind me. A chunk of rotten bark sloughed off, revealing a squirming, writhing mass of insects. Pillbugs and springtails and millipedes tumbled over each other, dropping onto the forest floor and seeking refuge in the shadows under the log. A giant centipede with dozens of pointed legs scrambled over the tree, disappearing to the other side. I eyed the girl's body warily. She wasn't breathing. Her chest was still. Her eyes weren't blinking. It certainly seemed like she was dead. So how did she move? That's when I realized the arm that had been draped across the girl's stomach was now at her side. It had slipped off her body and onto the ground. It was just gravity, no big deal. Embarrassed by my skittishness, I snorted out a short laugh and scooted back closer to the body. The arm that had slipped was the one with the angel tattoo and the silver bracelet. Curious, I pinched the heart-shaped charm between my fingers and angled it to see it better. There was a name etched onto it. Jessica. Jessica? Hadn't she said her name was Amy? I rolled my eyes skyward, then looked back toward the road, trying to mentally rewind our conversation. Yeah, it was Amy. She definitely said Amy. Before I could fully process what the disparity could mean, the girl moved again. Her back violently arched, then fell, then arched again. Her head rolled in my direction. A torrent of bright red blood poured from her mouth as her tongue emerged from between her lips and extended in my direction. It grew longer and longer, too long. That's not her tongue, I realized with mounting dread. It's a worm. I watched in mute horror as the worm expelled itself from the girl's mouth. It was slick and tubular, as thick as my wrist, and encased in a mucousy, brownish-red membrane the color of raw liver. At the end of its body was a gaping maw filled with concentric circles of pin-sharp, razor-edged barbs, all pointing inward toward a hungry, pulsing mouth. The worm twisted and writhed as it emerged, coiling itself on the ground next to the girl's head in a pool of blood-tinged slime. It was hard to gauge its full length, but it had to be 6 feet long, maybe 10, maybe more. And still, it kept coming. Finally, its tail end slipped out. Before I could react, the worm lunged at me, launching itself straight at my midsection. It was impossibly quick, more like the strike of a rattlesnake or a cobra than the clumsy wriggling you'd expect from a worm. I tried to dodge away, but the creature was too quick. Its razor teeth easily shredded and spiraled their way past my shirt, through the soft tissue under my ribcage and into my body cavity. I screamed. I tried to grab the worm, but my hands just slipped uselessly down the length of its ooze-slicked form. The worm's body whipped and thrashed as it burrowed into my torso, corkscrewing past my organs until it reached my spine. And somewhere deep inside its length, it extruded a needle-thin proboscis and injected it into my spinal cord, running it up into my skull. The probe branched into thousands of individual filaments that burrowed themselves deep into the crevices and folds of my brain. In an instant, my mind was flooded with a bright white surge of consciousness, a new form of hyper-awareness unlike anything I'd ever experienced before. I knew what the worm was, what it knew, what they all knew. There were millions of them, physically distinct but genetically identical, all of them connected at a quantum level to form a single superorganism with a shared universal consciousness. Every worm was linked to every other through space and time, from host to host, across the globe. Each worm's nervous system intertwined with that of its host, siphoning the host's memories, filtering them, devouring them, and digesting them. The words didn't feed on just any memories, though. They had no use for fond memories, no first words, first steps, or first kisses. Those memories were worthless. What the worms wanted, what they needed, what they thrived on, was pain. First, they consumed whatever painful memories were already there in the host. Then they made more. They drove their hosts to ever more horrible extremes, manipulating them like marionettes to create new memories upon which to feed, memories of tortures, murders, and worse, until the hosts' minds deteriorated from the strain. The hosts would begin to hallucinate, haunted by ghosts, plagued by demons. They'd become paranoid, reckless, insane. Eventually, the worm would manipulate the host to help it find a new host, a new home. Someone with untapped reservoirs of suffering. Someone with deep wellsprings of pain. Someone like me. As the worm's tendrils were assimilated into my brain, all the pain the creatures had consumed over millennia flashed through my mind in an endless stream of horrors. I saw warlords and murderers, rapists and kidnappers, politicians and priests. I saw them arm themselves with their weapons of war, their guns, their scriptures, their checkbooks. I saw brothels and boardrooms, slaughterhouses and sacristies, the pulpit and the resolute, nooses hanging, ovens burning, cities aflame. Then the vision slowed, focusing on a specific memory, a recent one, but not one of mine. The scene had a wavering, warbling quality as if it was a movie being projected through half-melted film. The sound was muffled and out of sync with the visuals, but it was enough to make sense of what I saw. I saw a heavyset girl with thick glasses and a round face, lured into the woods by a girl she thought was her friend. "This way, Jessica," I heard a familiar voice say. "It's back here." I saw the heavy girl's smile turn to laughter. Her laughter turned to shock. Her shock turned to terror. I saw a knife plunge into her chest, her side, her neck. I saw her pleading, "Why?" I saw her blood-soaked body rolled into a shallow grave already dug, her arms flopping limply over her mangled chest. I saw the silver bracelet with a heart pendant on her wrist, the one that was bearing her name, Jessica. I saw it being unclasped, then reclasped on a new wrist, a wrist with an angel tattoo. Amy's wrist. Then the vision sped up again. I began to recognize some of them. They were snippets from my own life. I saw myself at 5 as my father threw me across the room in a drunken rage. At 8, pounding on the locked cellar door, terrified that my mother had left me there to die. At 16, finding my best friend's body 3 days after a heroin overdose had left him slumped behind the wheel of his car. At 21, arguing with my girlfriend in the bathroom of our rundown apartment in West Hollywood. Alexis. The vision slowed again, playing out like grainy VHS footage with distorted underwater sound. I saw Alexis jabbing her long red fingernail into my chest as she berated me, insulted me, told me I was weak, pathetic, a balding loser who would never amount to anything. I saw my hands as I pushed her. I saw her high-heeled boots skidding on the slick bathroom floor, her temple smacking into the corner of the counter as she fell, her face hitting the floor with a dull thud. I saw the blood pooling on the tile. I saw her mouth open, her eyes close, her breathing stop. I saw her die. I saw myself looking in the rearview mirror. I blanked, then rubbed my hands over my face. I was in my car, parked in my garage at home. The ignition was off. The engine was cool. The garage door was closed. What had I done last night? Where had I been? I couldn't remember. My head was pounding. My back felt like someone shoved a red-hot wire up my spine. There was a dull ache in my side, just under my ribs, like that time in high school when I got nailed with a pitch at baseball practice. I looked at the clock on the wall of the garage. It was 6:15 a.m. My wife and kids would be awake any minute. I didn't have much time. Time for what? I didn't know. But whatever it was urgent. I had to hurry. As if on autopilot, I climbed out of the car, picked up a can of gasoline from the floor near the lawnmower, and grabbed a box of matches from the shelf by the grill. Entering the house, I splashed the gas around the living room, through the kitchen, and down the hall outside the bedrooms where my wife and children were asleep. Then, I struck a match. The gas ignited with a flare of light and heat that sent me stumbling back on my heels. The flames raced across the hallway, blackening the walls and filling the air with noxious smoke. "Stop it," I thought. "Help them." I tried to call out, but I couldn't make a sound. I had no voice. My limbs felt heavy and useless. I was frozen in place, paralyzed, unable to move. The only thing I could do was watch and listen. Screams rose inside each of the bedrooms. Screams of panic, then terror, then pain. The sound seared itself into my memory, and the worms began to feed. I hope you enjoyed Feed the Worm by Warren Benedetto, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Warren-Benedetto. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/WARREN-BENEDETTO. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. Shame. I'm telling you. If he just walked without rhythm, he wouldn't have attracted the worm. Or maybe he would anyway. I sort of forgot about that whole omniscient memory thing it has. Don't go just yet, folks. Warren Benedetto has one more frightful story to share with us this evening. This one is a delightful story of a home invasion, a terrified victim, and an alarm system that just might not be as helpful as advertised. Without further ado, I present to you The Door is Open. The back door is open, an automated voice said in a pleasantly informative tone. Carol's eyelids fluttered. They felt heavy, leaden. She groaned, then lifted her chin from her chest. An angry migraine kicked behind her forehead. The flickering light from the TV stabbed mercilessly at her eyes. Carol glanced at the empty wine goblet dangling between her fingers. There was a single, lonely drop of Merlot pooled at the bottom. She raised the glass to her lips and drained the sour liquid onto her parched tongue. And she grimaced. She hated the taste of red wine. That didn't stop her from drinking it, though. She needed it to sleep, to help her sleep. Isn't that what an Ambien's for? The voice in her head challenged her. Or is that the Xanax? Shut up, she mumbled. She placed the wine glass in the nightstand, then pushed a cluster of pill bottles away so she could see the clock. It was after 2 a.m. She fell backward on the bed and threw her arm over her throbbing eyes. She had to pick up Pete at the airport in just a few hours. Not only would she be demolished from lack of sleep, she'd be lucky if she even sobered up by then. Padding blindly around the bed, she found the remote control, then used it to turn off the TV. The bedroom went black except for a ghostly blue glow from the wall by the door. It took a minute for Carol's wine-soaked brain to register what the glow might be. Then she remembered. It was the security panel. The alarm system was new, only installed a few weeks prior. It was Pete's idea. Carol didn't think they needed one, but Pete insisted. He said he'd be traveling more for his job, speaking at conferences and doing guest lectures, and he wanted her and the baby to be safe while he was gone. Well, that was his excuse, anyway. Carol knew that wasn't the whole story, though. He would have canceled the alarm installation after she lost the baby if it was his. He didn't. Her mind still in a haze, Carol climbed out of bed and stumbled toward the security panel. She figured she might as well arm the damn thing. There was no point in having an alarm if she didn't turn it on. Besides, she knew Pete would be checking in on her via the mobile app. He'd be annoyed if he found out she'd gone to sleep without activating it. Squinting against the glow, Carol punched her PIN into the security panel's touchscreen, then pressed the button marked ARM. A failure tone buzzed, followed by an automated voice emanating from the speaker. "The back door is open." Carol furrowed her brow. She punched in her code again and pressed ARM. "The back door is open," the voice said again with identical inflection. "God damn it," Carol slurred. "Pete," she called out, massaging her eyes with her thumb and forefinger. "Close the door." "Pete's not here," the voice in her head reminded her. "Remember?" "Oh, that's right," she thought. Pete was away again at yet another academic conference in some forgettable flyover city in the Midwest. Was it Cleveland this time, or Cincinnati? Chicago. It was something with a C. It didn't matter. The point was, he wasn't home. She was alone. Again. "You sure about that?" Carol squeezed the bridge of her nose, trying to crush her migraine, and that annoying inner voice out of existence. She was sure the door wasn't open. She'd locked it before going upstairs. Still, it didn't hurt to double-check. She tied her robe closed, opened the bedroom door, and shuffled down the hall to the stairs. The house was quiet. The only sound was the soft brush of her heels on the hardwood floor. The stairs creaked as she took one step at a time, clutching the railing for balance. She paused about halfway down, listening. There was another sound now, an unfamiliar one. A long, slow, papery scratch. She peered over the railing, searching for the source. A dead maple leaf was scraping along the floor of the downstairs hall, propelled by an unseen current of air. It looked like a disembodied hand, skidding on the tips of its arched, bony fingers. As Carol stared at the leaf, another handful of leaves tumbled down the hall on a fresh gust of wind. A light dusting of snow glanced along the floor, swirling in the moonlight that angled into the hallway from the kitchen. The cold, wintered breeze ruffled the bottom of Carol's robe. She drew in a sharp breath. "The door is open," she thought. "It really is." Carol gathered the hem of her robe and quickly retreated up the steps. She patted as softly as she could on the cold oak floor, deftly avoiding the floorboards that she knew might creak, then slipped into the bedroom, slightly closed the door, and locked it with a click. Her heart raced in her chest. Had she locked the back door before coming to bed? She thought she had, but maybe she hadn't. She was at least three glasses deep in her bottle of Merlot by the time she decided to head upstairs. She might have forgotten. Or maybe she'd locked the door but hadn't realized it wasn't quite latched all the way. That happened sometimes, especially when it was damp. It was an old house, after all. Things didn't always line up the way they were supposed to. A strong wind could have blown the door open. The cameras, Carol thought. The security system had cameras monitoring every room and motion detectors that would show anything moving anywhere in a house. She could log into the mobile app and check the cameras. If there was someone in the house, she'd see them. Then she'd call the police and just wait in a room with the door locked until the cavalry arrived. Carol hurried over to her desk to retrieve her smartphone. Her fingers danced across the desk's surface in the dark, searching for the device in its usual spot. It wasn't there. Carol felt for the lamp. Her fingers found the base and worked their way up to the switch. A small pool of light flooded her desk. Her heart sank. The phone charger was empty. Carol closed her eyes and cursed silently. She'd left the phone downstairs, on the end table next to the couch. She could picture it clearly, face down on top of Pete's academic journals, a stack of publications with imposing titles like International Journal of Theoretical Physics and Quantum Quarterly. She'd gotten off the couch to pour herself another glass of wine in the kitchen, then had absent-mindedly carried the glass upstairs without returning to the den to retrieve her phone. Bang! A loud report echoed throughout the house like a gunshot. Carol jumped, startled by the sound. A pleasant voice issued from the security panel. The back door is closed. Carol relaxed. The back door had slammed shut. That's all the sound was. The wind again? No, it had to be. Carol walked over to the bedroom door, placed her ear against it, and listened. There was no talking, no footsteps, no sounds of any kind. Outside, a gust of wind rattled the French doors that led from the bedroom onto the balcony. Inside, the house was as silent as a tomb. Carol exhaled. The tension she'd been holding in her shoulders began to melt away. It seemed the wind really had blown the door open and now closed. Chiding herself a bit for her paranoia, she unlocked the bedroom door. And she paused. Maybe it's best to leave it locked, she thought. Better safe than sorry. She locked the door again, stepped over to the security panel, punched in her PIN code, and pressed arm. A familiar tone buzzed. A familiar voice intoned. There's motion in the kitchen. Carol frowned. She tapped a tab on the touchscreen panel, labeled motion. The display changed to show a schematic outline of her kitchen. A red triangle was pulsing by the back door. It began to move through the kitchen toward the hallway, toward the stairs, toward her. Panic flooded through Carol's body. She stepped back from the security panel as if to put more distance between herself and whoever was moving through her house. "Oh no," she whispered. It wasn't just the wind. Someone was in the house. A torrent of possibilities flooded Carol's mind. The first and most obvious was also the simplest. Maybe it was Pete. He wasn't due to return from his trip for another couple hours, but maybe his flight had been changed. Maybe he was home early. Maybe he'd taken a cab home from the airport so he didn't have to disturb her in the middle of the night. Or, oh no, maybe he'd been trying to call, trying to reach her. Her phone was downstairs, most likely with the ringer off. He could have been calling her, texting her, trying to let her know he was coming home, trying to arrange for her to pick him up from an earlier flight. When she didn't answer, he was forced to arrange his own ride home. That had to be it. "Pete?" she called out. Her tone was uncertain. "That you?" Before the words even left her lips, the voice in her head chimed in with a competing consideration. Why would Pete come in through the back? Carol clamped her hand over her mouth. The voice was right. Pete never came in through the back door. If he'd taken a cab, he would have come in through the front. Or, at worst, if he had forgotten his keys, he might have come in through the garage. But not through the back. Never through the back. The display on the security panel changed, drawing Carol's attention. The red triangle was moving out of the kitchen. The new readout showed a schematic of the downstairs hall, including the stairs upon which Carol had been standing just a few moments before. The triangle moved slowly down the hall to the bottom of the stairs. It stopped there as if listening. Carol froze, unconsciously holding her breath to avoid making even the slightest sound. After a moment, the triangle turned back down the hall and moved to the door under the stairs, the one that led to the basement. A mumbled curse echoed up through the floor. The utterance was followed by a series of thuds, as if someone was hitting or kicking the basement door. The walls in the bedroom vibrated with each impact. Carol mouthed a curse of her own. That wasn't Pete down there. Pete wouldn't try to break into the basement. He wouldn't even think of it. The door was 6 inches of triple-locked steel, more suited for a bank vault than a basement. The only way to open it was to enter the combination on its electronic lock. And Pete was the only person on Earth who knew the code. Even she didn't have it. It's not that I don't trust you, she remembered him telling her. It's just safer if you don't know. She'd never really thought much about the ramifications of that statement before. It was safer if she didn't know. That implied she would be in danger if she did know. But danger from who? A few months earlier, Pete had outfitted the house with the same research equipment as he had in his lab at the university, so he could continue his work from home while Carol cared for the baby. He insisted he was on the verge of a breakthrough. He couldn't afford to lose a second of progress. It was world-changing stuff, he said, the kind of discovery that would make him a shoo-in for the Nobel Prize. It would make them millionaires. Billionaires, even. Pete never said it, but Carol knew that's what the security system was for. Sure, he cared about her safety and the baby's, but mostly, he was protecting his work. If whatever he did in his lab was valued enough to make them billionaires and was worth locking down behind Fort Knox, level security, it wouldn't be surprising if someone wanted to steal it. Someone who might break in while Pete was out of town, expecting the house to be empty. But the house wasn't empty, was it? Nope. No, it wasn't. Not at all. You need to get out, her inner voice said. Run. Carol played out the option in her mind. It wasn't a crazy idea. From the stairs, it was a straight shot out the front door. If the intruder was down by the basement, she could probably make it outside without being caught. Once in the front yard, she could scream for help. Sure, she might look crazy, running barefoot through the snow in her bathrobe, smelling like a winery and slurring through an Ambien-induced haze. But it was better than whatever might happen if she stayed. Carol looked at the security panel again, hoping to see that the red triangle was still outside the basement door. It wasn't. The motion detector schematic had shifted to show Pete's library, an open room just off the foyer between the stairs and the front door. The red triangle was moving around inside as if searching for something. There was no way Carol could get past the library undetected. It would be too close, too risky. She'd have to pass virtually within arm's reach of the intruder. No, fleeing was not an option. She'd have to try something else. She needed to call for help. Her eyes searched around the room for a solution. They fell on her desk, on her laptop. Her eyes lit up. It was a MacBook. That meant it had the same messenger program as her iPhone. She could text Pete from there just like she could from her phone. Then she could have him call the police. She rushed to her desk, quickly flicked open the laptop screen. After selecting the messages icon, she opened a chat window and banged out a message to Pete in all caps. Someone in house. Need help. She hit send, and a pleasant whoop sound indicated that the message had been sent successfully. The tiny text below the message bubble showed that the message had been delivered. She stared at the screen, practically willing Pete to answer, trying to turn that delivered indicator to read, desperate to see the little three-dot animation that meant he was typing back. Come on, answer. God damn it, Pete, where are you? Not here, the voice in her head responded. Where he should be. A wave of anger coursed through Carol's system. Why wasn't he here? Why wasn't he home? Why was he flying around the country as if everything was normal, as if she didn't need him? It must be nice for him to be able to just move on, to lose himself in his work while she suffered in silence, alone, trapped in an empty house with a half-finished nursery filled with unopened toys. Ever since she lost the baby, he'd become even more consumed with his work, even more obsessed with finding an answer to some esoteric physics problem that only he understood. What did it matter? Why was it so important? Was it more important than her happiness? Her safety? Obviously it is. Otherwise he'd be here, with you. The creak of a floorboard in the hall caused Carol to sit up straight. She looked over her shoulder at the security panel. The schematic now showed the upstairs hall. The red triangle was directly outside her door. The bedroom doorknob rattled. Someone was trying to get in. Carol turned back to the laptop. Her message to Pete was still unread. Trying to minimize the clicking of the keyboard, she quickly typed another message. Call 911. A voice called from the hall. It sounded desperate. Hello? Is someone in there? Carol froze. She recognized that voice. It was more gravelly than usual, more strained, but there was no mistaking who it was. Oh my God, Pete! She flew to the door and fumbled with the lock. You scared the hell out of... Her words cut off as she opened the door. She took a step backward, her mouth agape. Pete? She said again. A figure rushed into the room. It was Pete. It definitely was. But he looked different. The clothes he wore were totally out of character. Pete dressed conservatively, usually in khakis and a colored shirt, with a sweater pulled over it in winter. Now he was wearing dirty jeans and work boots, with an oversized Carhartt jacket that smelled like motor oil. He looked more like a truck driver than a Harvard professor. Even more bizarrely, he had a full-grown beard. That was impossible. Pete had only been away at his conference for 2 days, and he had been as clean-shaven as always when he left. There was no way he could have grown a full beard in such a short amount of time. Similarly, his hair was 6 inches longer than when he left. It was as if months had passed instead of just days. "I need the code," he said as he entered. He closed and locked the door behind him. He looked panicked. Carol caught a whiff of body odor and filth. He smelled like the homeless guy that used to harass them outside their Boston apartment before they moved to the suburbs. His fingers were crusted with dried, reddish-brown streaks. "Is that blood?" Carol asked. Pete ignored the question. "Do you have it?" "Have what?" "The code," he said again, louder this time. "To the basement." "Of course not. Where is it?" "I don't know. You never gave it to me." Pete brushed by her and began rifling through the drawers of the desk. "Would I have written it somewhere?" "Don't you know it?" Pete moved from the desk to the dresser and started digging through the drawers, spilling clothes under the floor. "It's different here. The same, but different." "Pete, you're scaring me." He didn't respond. Instead, he disappeared into the walk-in closet. Carol could hear drawers opening and closing. Then she heard another sound farther away. Downstairs, her phone was ringing. It was Pete's ringtone, the one she had created based on their wedding song. Someone was calling her from Pete's cell phone. Carol felt frozen in place. How could Pete be calling her? He was here. Unless someone else had his phone. After a few seconds, the ringing stopped. Then it started again. In the closet, Pete didn't seem to notice the ring. If he did, he didn't acknowledge it. He was too focused on the notebook he'd found in one of the drawers. He flipped through the pages one at a time, running his fingers down the lines of neatly written notes, scanning them. Carol took a quiet step toward the laptop, hoping that Pete wouldn't notice her movement. He didn't. She peered at the computer screen. Three animated dots had appeared in the chat window next to Pete's name. Whoop! A message appeared in the chat. "Answer the phone." Before Carol could react, the laptop screen lit up with a small window featuring Pete's photo. "Incoming FaceTime call." The accompanying jingle played cheerily through the laptop speakers. Pete poked his head out of the closet, holding a stack of notebooks. "Who's that?" he asked. Carol looked at him, her eyes wild with panic and confusion. She glanced at the screen, then back at Pete. "It's you. Answer it." With that, Pete stepped back into the closet, out of view of the laptop camera. He closed the door quietly, leaving it slightly ajar, then turned off the closet light. She could sense him watching her through the darkened crack of the door. Carol sat down in front of the computer, and she clicked answer. On the screen, Pete's photo was replaced with a video. It was Pete. Her Pete. The Pete she recognized, clean-shaven, with short, neatly cropped brown hair. His hair was disheveled, sticking up in crazy spikes on one side of his head and pressed flat on the other. The room behind him was dark, but even in the phantom glow of the laptop screen, it was obvious that he was in a hotel. His eyes were blurry behind his black-rimmed glasses. "Carol," he asked, squinting into the camera. His voice was heavy with sleep. "What's wrong?" Carol stared wordlessly into the camera as she tried to process what she saw. His glasses, she realized. He never goes anywhere without his glasses, but the Pete in the room with her wasn't wearing any. "Where are you?" she asked. Her voice was tiny, almost a whisper. "I'm in Chicago. My flight doesn't leave for a couple hours. Are you okay?" "I don't know." "There's someone in the house?" "Yes." Tears began to spill down her cheeks. "Are they still there?"
"Yes."
She reached out and quietly tapped into the messenger window.
"He can hear."
She clicked send. Pete's eyes scanned the incoming message. He typed a reply while maintaining an innocuous verbal patter to the camera. "Okay, well, I called the police," he said. "Just stay put, they're on their way."
Whoop!
His text message appeared on Carol's screen. It read simply, "AirPods." Carol realized what he meant. If she put in her AirPod earbuds, the Pete in the closet wouldn't be able to hear what Pete on the laptop was saying. Luckily, Carol's AirPods were on the desk next to the laptop, right where they should be. Moving as slowly and imperceptibly as possible, she cupped the charging case in her hand, then removed one of the AirPods. With a motion like she was brushing her hair from her face, she slipped the AirPod into her ear.
"Can you hear me?
Blink for yes," Pete asked. Carol blinked. "You're at the desk, right?" She blinked again. "Okay. Open the bottom right drawer. Pull it all the way out. You'll see a black metal box way in the back." Carol leaned down and did as Pete instructed. Sure enough, a heavy-looking metal box was wedged between a row of hanging folders. "See it?" Pete asked, leaning close to the camera to observe what Carol was doing. She sat up and placed the box on the desk in front of the laptop.
"Good.
Okay. Combination is our anniversary. 11/19. Carol spun the small, numbered nails on the front of the box to the correct combination, then opened the box. Her eyes went wide.
"When did you get this?"
she whispered. "It doesn't matter. Just take it out and be careful." Carol lifted a handgun from the box, cradling it like it was made from delicate porcelain.
"I don't know how to use this," she hissed.
"Don't worry," Pete said calmly. "I'll explain." Behind Carol, the closet door opened. The other Pete stepped into the room. Carol spun in her chair and pointed the gun at him. He held up his hands.
Whoa, relax. "Get out," she yelled.
She stood up, her back to the computer. She held the gun aloft, handling the weight awkwardly. It was heavier than she expected. On screen, Pete's brow furrowed with concern.
"Carol!" he yelled.
He moved side to side, trying futilely to see past Carol's body.
"What's happening?"
"I'll shoot you, I swear to God," she said. The gun trembled in her hands.
"I just need to talk," the other Pete said.
He motioned past Carol to the laptop and the desk.
"To him."
"Who is that?" Pete's voice asked in Carol's AirPod.
"I don't know,"
Carol yelled.
"Pete, listening to me,"
the Pete in the room said, ignoring Carol.
"You were right. We were right."
"Who's we?" Carol cried.
"Who are you?"
"Carol, move," Pete shouted in her AirPod.
"Move away from the camera."
Carol stepped to the side, keeping her gun trained on the Pete in the room. From the laptop, Pete saw who was in the room with Carol. His face went slack.
He sat back in his chair, grabbed his hair in his fists, then leaned close to the camera again. The Pete in the bedroom took a step closer to the laptop.
"Pete, listen."
Carol tightened her grip on the gun and pointed it at his chest.
"Get back," she said.
He froze, his hand still raised.
"Carol, no,"
Pete's voice in the AirPod warned.
"Whatever you do, do not shoot him."
"Who is he?" Carol asked. A semi-deranged laugh burst from Pete's lips on screen.
"He's me."
"I'm him," the Pete in the room said simultaneously. He called past Carol to the face on the laptop.
"We don't have much time. The door is opening."
"What door?" Carol asked. She looked at her reflection on the darkened TV screen. A wave of realization crossed her face.
"This is a dream," she thought to herself. "It must be."
"It's the Ambien," the voice in her head agreed.
"You're tripping."
Pete waved at her from the laptop to get her attention.
"Carol, take out the AirPods. Let me talk to him."
Carol plucked the AirPod from her ear, then leaned against the bed's footboard, the gun dangling loosely in her hand. She watched as the two versions of her husband began to talk animatedly. The expression on her face was blank. She felt like she was losing her mind.
Had lost her mind. Past tense, it was long gone.
"Can you hear me?" Pete asked. With the AirPod out, the voice came through the laptop speaker.
"Yes,"
the Pete in the room said.
"Thank God, I need the code."
"What code?"
"To the basement. I need to get into your lab."
"Why?"
"To destroy it."
On the laptop, Pete's expression darkened.
"Destroy it? Are you crazy?"
"The fact that we're talking to each other means that it works. It means I was right."
He shook his head, then laughed a little.
"Ha! I was right."
"Almost."
Pete wilted a little.
"Almost?
I'll explain later."
"No, explain now."
"God damn it, I can't.
Do you want the code or not?"
Pete looked at his watch, then growled in frustration. He spoke quickly, running his words together.
"Okay, yes, there are alternate timelines, but they're not parallel, not always."
He held one hand flat over the desk, then held the other above it, turned at a different angle.
"They're at different planes. They don't intersect. They overlap, but they can be connected."
"Yes." In his hotel room, Pete slapped the desk. The laptop camera blurred and vibrated with the impact.
"I knew it."
Pete reached out and steadied the laptop screen.
"So the doorway works."
"Yes, but then why destroy it?"
"The Reachers."
He cut himself off, backtracking. "There are other worlds, other beings. In some timelines, they made contact with us. In some, they've taken over. If the door connects to one of those timelines, we're screwed. They'll wipe us out."
"But there must be infinite possible timelines.
How many of them involve us being wiped out?"
"All of them."
Suddenly a voice echoed from the security panel. "There's motion in the basement." The Pete in the bedroom looked at Carol.
"What was that?"
"Security system," Carol said. "Motion detectors." She pointed at the touch screen on the wall. Pete rushed over to the screen. It had switched to display a schematic of the basement. A blinking red arrow was positioned in the center of the room. It began to move toward the basement stairs. At the same time, another red arrow appeared. Then another. And another. Within seconds, the room was filled with arrows that overlapped each other like a swarm. The group began moving up the basement stairs and, as even more continued, spawning from nowhere. Pete's face went pale.
"We're too late."
"What's happening?" the Pete in the laptop asked. His voice sounded tinny and far away.
"We're too late," the other Pete shouted.
He stoned over to the laptop and leaned down to the camera, sneering.
"Because you needed your explanation and wouldn't just take my word for it."
Spittle flew from his lips and dotted the screen.
"God damn it!"
He turned back to Carol and held out his hand.
"Give me the gun." Carol clutched the gun to her chest and looked at the laptop.
The Pete on screen jumped from his chair and rushed off camera, disappearing out of view.
"Pete!" Carol called.
"Just hang on," Pete's voice answered from off screen. He appeared back in frame, standing with his phone in his hand. He tapped frantically on the screen. His hand was visibly shaking.
"I'm checking the cameras." Pete stopped tapping. He stared at the phone screen.
"What? What do you see?"
"The Reachers," the Pete in the bedroom whispered to himself. His eyes looked haunted. On the laptop, Pete leaned close to the camera. His voice was steady and direct.
"You have to get out of there. Now, run."
Suddenly, a series of thunderous impacts shook the floor, as if explosive charges had been set off downstairs. The double doors of the bedroom slammed in their frame as the shockwave reverberated through the house. Plaster dust drifted down from the ceiling like snowfall. Carol cried out in surprise. A pleasant voice in the security system spoke again. "The basement door is open." In the bedroom, Pete rushed back to the security panel and looked at the touchscreen. The red arrow spilled out of the basement staircase and into the downstairs hall. They began flooding into every room on the first floor, the kitchen, the living room, the study. Still more continued to materialize in the center of the basement. They appeared faster now, as if being poured from a faucet on full blast.
"They're coming," Pete said.
"Who's coming?" Carol asked, her expression crumpled. She looked at the laptop again.
"What's out there?"
On the laptop screen, Pete sat with his head in his hands, his glasses dangling from his fingers. He looked up at the laptop camera. His eyes were red-rimmed and watery.
"I'm sorry," he said, his voice trembling.
The laptop screen flickered. The bands of electrical interference raced across the display, distorting the image. Pete's face dissolved into a fractured mosaic of pixels, then froze. The laptop screen flickered again and went dark.
"Pete!"
Carol shouted, her voice cracking. Dropped the gun on the bed and rushed over to the laptop. Her hands shaking, she pressed the power button once, then twice. Nothing happened.
"Come on," she pleaded.
She pressed again, holding the button down this time.
"Come on, turn on."
She pounded her fist on the keyboard.
"Turn on, damn it!"
Bang! A gunshot rang out behind her. The sound was impossibly loud in the confines of the bedroom. Carol reflexively threw her hands over her ears, then spun around just in time to see the other Pete falling to the floor behind her. His limp body sprawled on the carpet, the gun in his hand, his mouth agape, his eyes staring vacantly at the ceiling. The left side of his head was blown wide open. Blood gushed from the wound in a torrent of dark red that soaked the snow-white rug. A spray of blood and brain matter was splattered on the wall behind him. It dripped from the security panel in long, elastic drops. The same electronic distortion that had killed the laptop was corrupting the display on the gore-streaked touchscreen. Still, the image was intact enough for Carol to recognize the motion detector view shifting to display a schematic of the stairs in the upstairs hall. Red arrows filled the stairwell as they began to amass outside the master bedroom. The security panel went black. A series of wet-sounding thuds started hitting the doors. As Carol watched in horror, a narrow black tentacle squirmed under the door. It found the pool of blood spreading from Pete's head. The end of the tentacle split in half vertically like a sideways eyelid, revealing a fleshy white tubule that looked like some sort of extended maggot or roundworm. The tubule glistened with clear ooze as it extruded from the end of the tentacle and into the blood. A series of contraptions rippled along its length. Its flesh began to turn from white to red. Carol's stomach reeled in revulsion. The tentacle, it was drinking. She stomped at the squirming appendage with her slippered foot.
"No! Get! Out!"
She screamed, punctuating each word with a stomp. The tentacle withdrew with blinding quickness, dragging a narrow trail of blood and slime along the carpet and under the door. Carol felt a brief surge of relief. Then the tentacle returned. A dozen more quickly followed. They seemed to be impossibly elastic, boneless and formless, almost gelatinous. Carol realized they weren't tentacles at all, not exactly. They were more like the pseudopods that an amoeba would extend to consume its microscopic prey. Some of the pseudopods dipped back into the still-spreading pool of Pete's blood. Others found the open wound on the side of his head. They squirmed their way inside his broken skull with a squishing sound that reminded Carol of fingers squeezing fistfuls of spaghetti. Somewhere in the room, glass shattered. Carol could hear the shards crashing onto the balcony outside. "The nursery window is open," the security system warned. Carol's stomach sank like a boat anchor. The nursery, with its walls still half-painted pink and a partially assembled crib coated in dust, was the room immediately adjoining the bedroom. Some of those things must have found their way into that room and out through the window onto the balcony, the same balcony that extended outside her bedroom. Carol turned and looked at the sprawling French doors behind her. The curtains were drawn, obscuring any clear view of the outside. But the light of the moon had turned the opaque white drapes into a sort of grotesque shadow play. Silhouetted just outside the glass was an undulating mass that rippled and deformed like a cluster of earthworms. The mass spread sideways across the length of the doors while rising upward as it ascended the glass. Within seconds, it had covered the windows, darkening them completely. A cracking sound split the air. Shards of glass fell to the carpet from behind the drapes. A freezing wind blasted into the room, lifting the curtains toward where Carol stood. Behind the flapping fabric, she glimpsed a writhing tentacle reaching through an empty window pane. It unlocked the door from the inside. Carol bent down, wrestled the gun from Pete's limp hand, and then pressed it to her temple. Tears streamed down her face. As the balcony doors crashed open, a friendly voice intoned, "The bedroom door is open." A frigid wind whipped Pete's filthy hair across his eyes. He shivered and zipped his ill-fitting Carhartt jacket fully closed. He'd scavenged the coat from the cab of an overturned oil tanker after his own parka had become too shredded to keep him warm. The Carhartt was two sizes too big, but it was better than nothing. Boston was freezing. As Pete stepped over the desiccated corpse sprawled face down on the university building steps, he glanced at the bullet-riddled sign hanging askew next to the entrance. Even without his long-lost glasses, he could still read it. Harvard University. Then, in peeling black letters below, Department of Physics. He took a deep breath, brushed the snow from his beard, and entered the building. It had been 3 months since his discovery had unleashed hell from the basement of his quaint Cambridge home. 3 months since the rift between dimensions had torn apart. 3 months from Chicago to Boston, on foot, walking, running, hiding, only to find his worst fears confirmed. Carol was dead. His only consolation was she'd taken her own life, avoiding a death of unimaginable horror. Once in our world, the Reachers had swept across the country like a swarm of ravenous insects, radiating outwards from the interdimensional doorway in all directions, consuming every living thing in their path. There was no way to stop them, no way to close the door once it was opened. The only way to end the destruction was to prevent the door from existing in the first place. And that's exactly what Pete intended to do. Water dripped from the ceiling as he made his way down the darkened hall toward his old laboratory. The building was in ruins. Furniture was piled ceiling high in doorways. And at the end of hallways, signs of a futile last stand against the insatiable hunger of the Rachers. Boston had been the first city to fall within hours of the door opening. Nobody even knew what had hit him.
Pete felt nauseous thinking about his colleagues, about the terror they must have felt as the Reacher's amorphous pseudopod slipped through the gaps in their makeshift barricades, seeking the delicious warmth of flesh and blood. He found it hard to believe that his old laboratory, his original laboratory in the university building, would still be intact and functional, but it had to be. That was the only way to explain how a different version of himself could have shown up at his own house in an alternate timeline, attempting to destroy his invention. His double must have opened the doorway into Pete's timeline from another, and there was only one place on Earth where that could have happened. His own lab. Pete arrived at the door of his laboratory. It was undamaged. As he turned his key in the lock, he paused. What if, by opening a portal into another dimension, he provided a way for the Reachers to follow him through? What if he was dooming another timeline to the same fate as his own? His mind flashed back for a moment to the conversation he had with his double right before this nightmare started. But there must be infinite possible timelines, he had said. How many of them actually involve us being wiped out? A shudder rocked his body as he remembered his double's answer. All of them. It couldn't be true. There had to be at least one where everything worked out okay. Not just this one thing. Everything. A timeline where Carol survives, where she picks him up from the airport after his trip exactly as planned, where they finish the nursery just in time to welcome their healthy new baby girl, where they were happy. That's all he ever wanted. That's all his research had ever been about. He knew that alternate reality had to exist somewhere. He just had to find it. Pete entered his lab and closed the door behind him. The room was dark and dusty, but it was otherwise unscathed. As he had hoped, his invention was intact. He powered it on and stepped back and watched in awe as a rift between dimensions began to appear. Through the portal, he could see a double of his lab on the other side. It was identical to the one he was in, except it was bright and airy. Sunlight streamed through the windows, reflecting off a smooth blanket of new-fallen snow outside. The world looked fresh, unspoiled, alive. Pete felt a swell of hope. There was still time. As he stepped toward the portal, he caught a glimpse of movement out of the corner of his eye. A thin black pseudopod was slipping soundlessly under the laboratory door. It slithered up and curled around the knob. Pete lunged for the switch to cut the power to his invention. But it was too late. The door was open. I hope you enjoyed The Door is Open by Warren Benedetto, as performed by yours truly. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. And, once again, I'd like to give a nice big thank you to all of tonight's featured authors. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and it would mean a lot to us. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyre channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as well. Just search for Otis Gyre. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groshek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?